Good morning. We're here at Matan studying Judaism and the isms. And last week we studied Judaism and Hinduism. And I hope that that generated some interesting discussion for you at the Shabbat table or with your kids or whoever. And now, next week, please God, we're going to study Judaism and Buddhism. Like next week. This week is Judaism and environmentalism. Okay? Now, let's talk about environmentalism, and let's talk about, this is obviously a very pressing issue. How do we look at the environment? What is Judaism's perspective on nature, on the world, the created world, animals? This is very pressing. We know, unfortunately, in Australia, there are terrible, devastating fires that are wiping out whole populations of animals, killing tons of trees, obviously also causing much destruction for human beings and smog and illnesses as a result of this. And it's very, very concerning. Please God, the fires should stop. But this raises some really interesting questions about our responsibility towards the environment. One of the questions that hangs over this incident in Australia is, first of all, are people igniting these fires or is it natural? But beyond that, of course, what's happening to our planet that we're having such devastating fires? And it's not just Australia, it's also California, it's other places as well. Water sources are drying up. It's clear that, according to the vast, vast, vast majority of, 99.9% or whatever of climate scientists and astrophysicists and all these different scientists, the things that we're doing to the world are affecting the world. Okay, so we have a role in climate change. It's not a political thing; it's just science. And the question is, what does Judaism think about this? And I want to share with you two quite provocative articles here. Okay, right at the beginning, that condemn Judaism and our role in the world here. Okay, so let's start with. We'll start at the bottom with Chava Tirosh Chen, professor at Arizona State University. She quotes here, I'm really just interested in who she quotes, a person by the name of Lynn White Jr. Does anybody know who Lynn White Jr. was? Or, if I'm mistaken, professor of sorts. Along with Christianity, she writes, Judaism has been indicted as one cause of our current environmental crisis. In his famous essay, Lynn White Jr. alleged that the anthropocentrism, what's anthropocentrism? That man is in the center, okay, of the Judeo-Christian tradition, made it possible to exploit all nature in a mood of indifference to the feeling of natural objects. According to White, the biblical command to fill the earth and subdue it is the proof that the Judeo-Christian tradition puts humans above the rest of creation and regards all other forms of life as subordinates.
I think there's a lot of things in that statement.
What is incorrect there?
First of all, if you go back to the start of man and his past, the history, conquering other nations.
Mm-hmm.
You have go back to the explorers, you go back to Spain, France, England.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout our history, man has not exactly been
good to other human beings. Okay, but it doesn't mean that we were good to the planet, right? What he's saying here is that destruction of our planet is because of Jewish values written into the first parak of Tanakh. Agree or disagree? Okay, interesting. You're saying there's this other pasuk, which seems to point otherwise. What else? Agree or disagree? What other ideas, halachot, mitzvot, might relate to this notion? Yeah? Okay, or the not taking Orla till the fourth year and bring it to Yerushalayim, yeah? Shemitah, okay. Everything was created good. Okay, but that could mean...
In the sanitation requirements.
Oh, cleaning up in the Machaneh Tzva'i. They had to clean up, okay. Oh. Interesting. I don't know that. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
All these things, no, we done in the fourth year in cleaning up and then there was a lot of nonsense, but
Yeah, but these things haven't been in practice. Are Jewish ideas responsible for the destruction of nature today and exploitation of the planet? Okay, let's see what Toynbee has to say about this. Arnold Toynbee. Yeah, oh, are there any extra source sheets?
Oh, over there.
Yeah. Okay, Arnold Toynbee is a thinker, a very popular thinker, public intellectual in the 40s, 50s, 60s, historian. And here's what he has to say about this. This is an article from the New York Times, September 16th, 1973. This is like during the Yom Kippur War, I guess, right? Same time. The genesis of pollution. Okay, let's see what that means, the genesis of pollution. For about 200 years, the advance of the Industrial Revolution has been accelerating. At the same time, it has been increasing in potency. The 19th century, its triumphs were applauded by its beneficiaries, though not by its more numerous victims. In the last quarter of a century, however, everyone, including the beneficiaries, has rather suddenly become aware of large and sinister entries on the debit side of the account. The manufacture and use of two atomic bombs in 1945 made it impossible for us to shut our eyes any longer to the truth. Technology is a morally neutral instrument for enhancing human power, an instrument that can be put to work either for good or for evil. We then realized that even if we were to achieve the difficult feat of making it possible, okay, we're skipping, he's just going through, go to the next paragraph, what is the explanation of the improvidence that has now alarmed us and put us to shame? The superficial explanation is that man, like every other being, is greedy. That the capacity and impulse to try to exploit the rest of the universe is another name for life itself. Man's greed differs from that of other living beings, not in the strength of the impulse, but in the degree of the capacity. Our ancestors became human. There's a book, Guns. What is it? Oh, Guns, Wars.
Germs and Steel.
Germs and Steel. And the case the book made was that guns enabled us to dominate nature in a way that you can never, you know, otherwise it was you versus a lion, you know, you have your sword and the lion's got its teeth and you figure it out, or, you know, you try to defend yourself. With a gun you could shoot from a mile away and you don't even have to, and this has led to the domination of nature, okay? Our ancestors became human in the act of inventing tools, and over the last two centuries we have discovered how to increase the potency of our tools enormously. We have achieved this by harnessing one after another the physical forces of inanimate nature. Okay, we've become very powerful. All of this is obvious, but is equally as, okay, so it's greed. Greed is the cause of destruction of the world. All of this is obvious, but is equally obvious. It is not only the latest chapter of a long and unfinished story. We must push our inquiry further back. There's something that precedes just human greed. In combating intolerance and violence, the pioneers of the Enlightenment were not challenging the Christian doctrine about the relation between man, God, man, and nature. This doctrine is enunciated in one sentence in the Bible. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. This is the word subdue it. Is anyone know what the word is in Hebrew? V'chibshuha, v'chbosh, to conquer. According to the Bible, God had created the world. The world was his to do what he liked with it. He had chosen to license Adam and Eve to do what they liked with it, and their license was not canceled by the fall. The tenant who had parked in the garden rent-free was now rack-rented. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, but as an offset, the disgraced human tenant expelled from the Garden of Eden, let loose in the wild world, was not prohibited from easing the payment of his punitive rent to God by harnessing natural forces to do his work for him. Genesis 1:28 gave the license. Genesis 3:19 provided the incentive, which is by the sweat of your brow. In 1663, this read like a blessing on the wealth of Abraham in children and livestock. In 1973, it reads like a license for the population explosion, like both a license and an incentive for mechanization and pollution. Goes on. Some of the major maladies of the present-day world, in particular the recklessly extravagant consumption of nature's irreplaceable treasure and the pollution of those that man has not only devoured, can be traced back to a religious cause, and that this cause is the rise of monotheism. Pretty harsh critique here, yeah.
That's also saying it's only the monotheistic religions that promote greed and that the others don't. Is what.
Well, who is this in contrast to? Who is this in contrast to? Spoke about in the first class. Perhaps in contrast to pagans, who sacralize nature. right, who believe that nature is sacrosanct. Not that they don't have their, what the Romans and the Greeks didn't destroy things. I mean, they certainly did as well, but not to the same. This he sees as license for wanton destruction. Now, let's assume that you had to debate Alfred Toynbee. What case would you make for Judaism? What would you say? I mean, what points would you make? Does Judaism justify, condone wanton destruction?
No. We're not supposed to cut down fruit trees.
We're not supposed to cut down fruit trees. Okay, yeah. Yeah, what do you think?
You can't hunt for the sake of killing. You can't hunt for the sake of killing. Kill an animal for your food.
Okay. Okay, well, let's say, you know, listen, I'm from Texas. I like a big, mean steak every single day. I mean, is that wanton destruction? Is that, I mean, do I need to have my second house, you know, in the Bahamas? Like, what, I just want to, you need a house to live in. We all agree you need a house. Do I need a second house? Beautiful mansion, you know, I'm going to cut down some trees to build that mansion. Is that, I'm going to fly there on my personal jet? I mean, is that considered wanton destruction? What if I have two cars instead of one? Is that, maybe I should be taking more public transportation? Do I, huh? It's not in the Shulchan Aruch? I mean, there are some really, do I need to buy a hybrid car? Do I need to buy a car that is, an electric car that's better for the environment?
There are things that aren't codified in Jewish law, such as, where you can't put certain industries in certain locations.
Okay, correct. You have to be sensitive to the, you know, pollution, correct.
And so, you know, as for example, a tannery, which was known for...
Tannery, correct. That's an example of Bava Batra, correct. Correct. No, you have to be aware of natural resources a little bit, but I don't know. Yeah.
This is a very modern problem. It's only the last 100 or so years that we've had the ozone layer and everything. So it's more global. You can't blame it on anyone.
Talk about being a modern power. I want to show you something that is shocking and disturbing and fascinating all at the same time, okay? Just go to the second page for a second. Let's look at the word disposable. I quoted this once in Shifta. Page 2, disposable. Okay, disposable in the 1640s, the Oxford Etymological Dictionary. 1640s, that may be done without. Sense of free to be used as the occasion may require. Let's say I have a special Kiddush cup for Pesach. It's disposable because I don't need it every week, but I use it special for the Seder. Available is from the 1650s. Meaning designed to be discarded after one use is from 1943. Disposable only came to mean something that you use once and throw out and never ever use again, and it goes to a garbage dump and takes 500 years to biodegrade. That's from 1943. It's originally of diapers. Soon... Soon of everything.
Effectively, this is at your disposal. This, as you say, this matter. I could use it.
Exactly. It's at my disposal. I have it when I need it. I don't throw it away in between. Disposable meaning that you throw away something and never use it again, and it sits in some landfill. It's only 1943. Now, why didn't this meat definition exist before that? I don't know, it's interesting. When were plastics created for the first time? I don't know, it's an interesting question. But, you know, they say that, you know, the woolly mammoth, the ancient Indians, you know, would use every part of them. Sorry, Indians weren't around. I mean, whatever. They would use the bones, they would use the fat, they would use the skin, they'd use the meat. I mean, there was nothing left after you killed an animal, right? Whereas we use things and they stay around for a very, very long, long time. And Nachon, so this is...
When they came out with statistics, how much plastic is being... It shocks you.
Correct. It definitely does. So what I want to do is take a look at the Jewish perspective on nature. Okay? and our connection to the world and the environment and our responsibility towards it. So let's start with the, you know, there's an author by the name of David Vogel who makes the case, and we'll look at it inside a little bit later, that the key term when it comes to a Jewish perspective on the environment is balance. It's all about balance, okay? And he argues that nature doesn't have any independent rights of its own, certainly don't sacralize nature. However, we have a responsibility towards nature. But it's about balancing different needs, competing needs, competing interests. Okay, let me give you, so first of all, in terms of the verse in 126, Bereshit, which we read already, well, look at another verse, just in the next parak, Vayikach Hashem Elokim at the bottom of page 1, Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam, Vayanicheu vigan even le'ovda ul'shomra. So on the one hand, we're told that we could conquer, conquest, I don't know if exploit's the right word, but use, definitely use and utilize the universe. The other hand, we're told that we have to protect and guard the universe. Okay, so we have a dichotomy here. There's a balance. By the way, the same thing is true about man being created on the sixth day. There's a discussion. Why were human beings created on the sixth day? What does it say about our place in nature? What? Is last best or last? Worse.
At every stage of creation, that which was created was one level
more advanced. More advanced. Okay, so when we address the...
Which is why men have to wrap up their arms.
Ah, that's good. I like that. That's why Elaine said that woman was created after man. There's a higher level of...
A higher level.
Closest to, you know, Shabbat. Nachon. So the very interesting, but... there's one midrash that suggests that, you know, first God creates the banquet and then he invites the premier guest, and that's human beings to be created on the sixth day. Mm-hmm. And that's one interpretation, in which case we're the apex of the creation, best comes last. The other interpretation is that there's another midrash which suggests that why did God create us after the gnat? So that when we become too arrogant, God will say, you know, the gnat came before you, you know, in a sense. You're really in... Get back in line, you know. So the different interpretation. But again, you have that balance. Let's look at the mitzvah. We're going to study for a second the mitzvah of bal tashchit, which means not to destroy. Okay. But the context for this is important. And one question that we're going to raise is how broad. What is the scope of this prohibition of not destroying fruit trees in war? Okay. How do we apply this to other situations? Are there certain limitations? Let's look at Dvarim Perek Kaf. We're in the second source on page 2. Ki tatsur el ir yamim rabim. When you siege a city for a long period of time, lehilachem aleha, to fight it, litovsa, to capture it, lo tashchit et eitza lindoach alav garzen. Don't destroy the trees and cut it down with a garzen. What's a garzen? An axe. Ki mimenu tochel. You rather, you should eat from it, ve'oto lo tichrot. And don't cut it. What does that mean? Is a man like, ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, is man is like a tree, that it should come before you in a siege? What does that mean? What does it mean? Ki ha'adam, there's some equivalence here. We're going to have to look at two different interpretations. There's an equivalence here made between human beings and trees. Anybody see The Lord of the Rings? Aren't in The Lord of the Rings there are trees that are sort of alive? What are the names of those trees? Remind me. Anybody know? Okay. Homework for next week. Okay. Rak eitz asher teda ki lo eitz ma'achal hu. Only trees which you know that are not fruit-bearing. Hu oto tashchit. Those you should destroy, the charata uvanita matzor la'ir. Use those trees to build a siege wall, whatever it is, or attacking ram. Asher hi osa imcha milchama ad ridita. So don't use the fruit-bearing trees, use the... Now, is it saying you can't destroy anything? So it's saying don't go to war? The war is justified. It's even permitted to use, I don't know, you know, some of the trees here. Okay. The,
so you can't cut the tree down with an axe, but that doesn't mean that you can't take the branches.
What, with your hands? How do you break trees off? I don't know. How are you going to get the branches off without an axe? What's the other option?
A saw.
A saw. Okay, well, let's assume a saw and an axe are going to be interpreted.
No, but it's because you cannot cut it, cut down the tree.
You're saying it's dafka, don't cut the whole tree. You're saying take a branch, but don't cut the whole tree. That's what you're saying.
You can't denude the tree of its fruit to deprive the residents of the city of the food.
Uh-huh.
You just can't destroy the tree.
Uh-huh. And the source of life itself. Interesting. Okay. And very interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also not saying you can't. Again, you could use wood. It's just don't, you know, use certain types of wood. Be selective. Let's look at Rashi and the Ibn Ezra. Okay. So first, Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, Dvarim Perakaf Pasuk Yutet. Ki mimenu tocha v'otolo tichrot. Ki adam eifet zedeh. V'hatam, the rationale, the reason here. Ki chayei ben adam hu eifet zedeh. The source of life for a human being is a tree, fruit. The kamohu, as it says, ki nefesh hu chovel. Okay, this is another source where you're hurting a soul. Ki chayei nefesh hu chovel. Ve'oto lo tichrot, davek im lavo mipanecha bamatzor. Hinei, lo tashrit eitz pri shehu chayim leben adam. Don't destroy a tree because it provides life for a human being. Rak mutar shetochamim, but you can eat from it. Ve'asur lecha lehashchito kidei shetavo ayir mipanecha b'matzor, but you can't destroy it. What is the rationale for not destroying a tree here, a fruit-bearing tree here? It's food for man. This is about sustainability for us. This is because it's good for us. Why would you destroy your own food sources? Gotta say, you have to have, use your resources carefully so that you have more left at the end. Okay? Don't destroy the sources of life themselves. This is what we call an anthropocentric worldview. It's not that nature is as independent value. Just from our perspective, God is telling us, use your resources properly. Okay? Now, again, I'm not saying there's still something ethical here or sensitive. I don't know if ethical is the right word. That's only to do with human beings, perhaps. But there's something sensitive here about the environment, but it's more about what our needs are. Okay? Well, let's look at Rashi. Rashi is different because Rashi is a fundamentally different starting point. Rashi ki adam eitz hasadeh, harei ki mishamesh b'lashon dilma. Harei, in this context, means dilma, perhaps. Okay? Key in this case. Mishamesh b'lashon dilma. Key in this case means perhaps. Perhaps. Shema ha'adam eitz hasadeh liikanes b'toch matzor mipanecha liityaser b'yisurei ra'av v'tamei kanshei ha'ir lama tashchitenu. Rashi's saying it's a rhetorical question. Is a tree like a human being? That he's involved in this siege and this war, that the tree needs to be, destroyed, just like the people of the city? And the answer is no, of course it doesn't have to be. It's wasteful. Now, what's the basis for Rashi saying that you shouldn't destroy this tree? Is this about sustainable development, anthropocentrism? What is it saying? It's not that. It's not from the standpoint of man. It's saying that the tree is like a beautiful thing. What are you destroying it for when you don't need to? Why would you? It's because, this is more of a, we'll call it an ecocentric perspective. God created nature. Nature has beauty. It's God's creation. We don't sanctify it. We don't worship it. But we recognize that it has some inherent value. And it's not just for us. It's not about us. It has independent value of us.
Yeah. That applies to all the trees?
That would apply to all the trees, but then we say, but you still do need resources, so cut down these trees and not others. The fundamental premise is, ideally, you wouldn't destroy anything. In a case of war, where you need this for the sake of life or death, you would be permitted to use it. Yeah.
I think it's perhaps the biblical version of the Israeli doctrine of Tol HaMeshech.
Uh-huh.
War is perhaps a necessity. But we need to be sensitive not to destroy everything correct. In our path and pathway.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
What second? What property is?
What is property?
Property.
What does it mean, property? Okay. Good. Yeah. No, we're going to get to there are going to be a lot of interesting questions here about exactly the scope and the parameters here. We're getting there, okay? Now, I'll just give you one more example of this. So we see here sort of this contrasting dichotomous perspective. On the one hand, an anthropocentric, but also an ecocentric perspective, okay? And I think, again, it goes back to this notion of balance. One more example, there's a notion of sending away a mother bird before you take the eggs, okay? Which is called Shiluach HaKen. What's the rationale behind this? So Abravanel points to the fact, well, if you take the mother and the bird, you're going to destroy the source of, you're not going to have any more production of eggs for human beings to use, for our toelet. Okay, that's the anthropocentric perspective. Whereas the Ramban says, you're going to end up, causing extinction to a species. Nothing to do with us, it's about the animals themselves. Okay, so again, the anthropocentric, ecocentric perspectives, this is a distinction that Vogel lays out in his article, okay, using a number of different examples. Now what I want to get to is the parameters of Baal Tashchis. All we see here is a case of war and a case of fruit trees. So, let's say I'm having a bad day. I take a sledgehammer right aside. I'm going to just destroy this whiteboard to get rid of my anger. I mean, a whiteboard doesn't say lo tichrod or lo tashchit whiteboard from the Torah. I mean, it doesn't say that I can't destroy other things. It seems to be just this object. Okay, so let's look at the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim Perek Vav. Okay, let's look at Halacha Yud. V'lo ha'ilanot bilvad. It's not only ilanot, it's not only trees that you may not destroy. The Rambam generalizes here. Ela kol ha'mishaber kelim. And he's based on the Gemara, of course. Anyone who destroys vessels, v'korea bigadim, rips clothing, v'horeis binyan, destroys buildings, v'sotei ma'ayan, closes up a ma'ayan, a water source, u'me'abed ma'chalot derech hashchata, and destroys food, derech hashchata. What's derech hashchata mean? In a destructive manner, or maybe with destructive intent, over below tashchit. Meaning it's not just fruit trees, it's all objects in the world. Okay? And let's look at the Sefer HaChinuch, who has a really very beautiful idea here, but it's even more expansive. Sefer HaChinuch, mitzvah tav kuf kaf tet. Shorish ha-mitzvah yadua, shu kedei delameid nafshenu le'aho, batov v'hatoelet yidabek bo. God wants us to love good things. Good values. Mitoch kach tedabek banu hatova v'narchik mikol davara umikol davar shchata. V'zeo derech hachasidim. This is the way of the chasidim. V'anshei maasei ohavim shalom. They love peace. Usmechim v'tov abriot. They love the goodness of nature. Umekavim otam l'Torah, and briot in this case is other human beings. They bring them closer to Torah. Lo yovdu afilu gargar shel chardal ba'olam. They don't even waste a mustard seed. How big is a mustard seed, please tell me? Very tiny. They don't even waste a mustard seed. You know that 40% of the food in Medinat Yisrael is thrown out on a daily basis. Okay? They don't even waste a mustard seed. V'yetzer alehem, b'chol avdon v'ashchata shir'u. It bothers them. It really bothers them when they see destruction. V'im yochlu latzil yatzilu, and if they could, they would save it. Kol davar me'am mashchit. The kolchokham, they would save everything with all of their energy. Their brothers, meaning, and there's not like the other people who are wicked, who destroy things wastefully. So this is an extent. This is Baal Tashchit. Okay. Now, again, what about for human use? Okay. You need to build a house, so you need resources. You need to expand the town and there's a forest. I'm not talking about the way Ra'anana cuts down a tree. That's want and destruction. We all could agree on that. I'm talking about, there's need. Okay? So let's talk about, we're going to look at an article here by Rabbi Yoshua Pfeffer. Okay? Who has a website, which answers some halachic questions. I thought this was a very good summary of this prohibition. So let's look at the bottom of page 2, application of the prohibition. The Torah prohibition of Baal Tashchit is mentioned specifically about fruit trees, concerning which we are commanded to not destroy its trees. However, even somebody destroys just the fruit transgresses the prohibition, as Chazal derived from a kal vachomer. If we are warned against destroying a fruit-producing tree, how much more so are we warned concerning the fruits themselves? Moreover, in the Gemara we find the application of the prohibition to all things beneficial, including animals, vessels and utensils, food, and clothing. However, because the principal prohibition is stated in the case of fruit trees, only actually destroying a fruit tree is punishable by Torah lashes. The Rambam said that. He said only destroying the trees you get lashes. Everything else you're still violating a prohibition. One who destroys other things is punished by rabbinic malchus, as the Rambam writes, not trees alone, but rather anybody who smashes household goods, tears clothes, demolishes a building, stops up a spring, or destroys articles of food, transgresses bal tashchit, yet he receives only lashes on a rabbinic level.
Is
that not
for
his
much?
Say again? What did you say? Malkut Midivrahem is subject to the Dayan, the judge's determination of how many to give. Although some writes of the Rambam includes other items only as a rabbinic prohibition, the consensus of commentaries is that the destruction of all beneficial things is a Torah offense. So the Torah punishment applies only to destruction of fruit trees specified by the first. Okay, there should be a space here. Yes? That's a really interesting question, what happened with Gushkatis on a number of levels. You think they should have kept the homes? I don't know. Yeah, well, okay, so I don't want to discuss right now whether they should have given it back. That's an important question, which doesn't fit into this topic. It fits into other topics, but not this one. I don't know, what do you do in a situation, should they have destroyed the homes or not? I don't know, I don't know, what do you think? What are the two sides here? Say again, what? So you think they wouldn't have shot the missiles if they got the homes?
No. The Arabs destroyed everything that was there. They really didn't care. They just wanted to...
I mean, it's a very good question about, you know, was it a violation of Baal Tashrit? I think...
I was looking at a house in Michigan that was in the pathway of an interstate highway in Greenville.
Yeah.
And so my husband and I were the last tenants. In this house.
Yeah.
And so before we left, we took what we could out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The house was built in 1940 with these nice glass doorknobs.
Yeah, you don't want it, nachon. Otherwise it just goes to a wasteful dump.
So, I mean, if people in Jewish countries have decided, well, we're going to take all the faucets, we're going to take all the light fixtures, we're going to take all the plumbing fixtures, and, you know, let's just take everything out.
I mean, listen, this is obviously a complicated situation because we're dealing with an enemy, you know, and, you know, what would have been even worse, you know, salt to the wound was seeing videos of someone literally taking your house and going and living in your house. I mean, that would... They destroyed the Baconess. We did leave the Baconess. They even destroyed the, you know, so it's... I imagine the homes they probably wouldn't have destroyed because they could use them, but they destroyed the Beit Knesset, right? I think it's... Hamas is definitely in violation of not only Baal Tashrit, but in many, many other forms of destruction. I think we could agree on that. Okay, cutting down trees for a purpose. The prohibition against destroying a fruit tree is not absolute, and there are instances in which it's permitted to do so. There are some mitzvot, by the way, where we destroy things. When you rend a garment for a mourner, you're destroying a garment, essentially. How is that permitted? Isn't that Baal Tashrit? Chazal derived from a textual interpretation that there was a need to cut down trees to build a bulwark. One must first seek barren trees. But if these cannot be found, it's permitted to cut down a fruit-bearing tree for the purpose. A number of early commentators are at different instances which permit to cut down fruit trees as part of a military campaign. To explain, the Jewish soldier must trust in Hashem that they will be victorious and will ultimately come to eat the fruit of the trees. Ramban writes that it is permitted to raise a forest to the ground if this is required to prevent the enemy from gathering wood or from hiding therein. The Skuni likewise adds that trees can be cut down to prevent enemy soldiers from fighting guerrilla warfare. And the Rashbam adds that trees can be cut down to allow soldiers to come close to the besieged city. Baal Tashkis for other purpose. That's all in terms of war. Okay, different instances of war. It is likewise permitted to destroy things where a beneficial human purpose is achieved. Now, this is the million-dollar question. What is considered beneficial, human purpose? For instance, it is permitted to break a glass cup at a wedding in memory of the destruction of the temple. Although this is an act of destruction, the constructive purpose of recalling the temple permits the act. In the same way, it is permitted for a mourner to rend his garments when mourning a lost relative, though it is forbidden to tear noticeably more than is required. And only for exceptional Torah scholars is it permitted to tear extra garments. The prohibition cannot be specified exactly, but the general rule is that where the destruction is beneficial and required, it is permitted, but it is forbidden if excessive. We also find in the Gemara that one of the Moraim performed acts of destruction for educational purposes, demonstrating his extreme disapproval of his children's improper behavior. The Gemara writes that the Gemara is careful to break vessels that were in any case due to be broken, leading some authorities to rule that it is forbidden to break intact vessels for educational purposes, though it is clear from Tosfot that he maintains it is permitted to break even intact vessels for this purpose. Financial benefits alone. Even for financial benefit alone, we find permission to cut down fruit trees. The Gemara clarifies this ruling, explaining in the name of Avina that if the value of the tree as raw material for building is greater than its value as a fruit tree, one is permitted to cut it down. Okay, that's very significant. The Gemara demonstrates this principle for the case of Shmuel, who cut down a date palm that caused damage to a nearby vine. The taste of the wine was adversely affected by the palm tree. Another anecdote mentioned by the Gemara is the case of Rav Chisda, who cut down date palms because their yield was no longer profitable. The Rambam notes these examples in his rulings on the subject and rules in a responsum that it is permitted to cut down a palm tree that threatened to damage a Muslim mosque that stood nearby. Another problem is that people threw stones at the tree, injuring passerbys. In the words of the Rambam, the Torah only prohibited cutting down in a destructive manner, as it says, you shall not destroy its tree. The Rambam is saying something very expansive here. If something is wasteful, there's no human use or constructive purpose, then you may not destroy it. But if there is a human benefit that comes from it, you could destroy the tree. I mean, this seems to go pretty far, the Rambam. Yeah?
What?
Except for? Correct. So I think that also now, that's something that we recognize today we might not have recognized in the past. That's something we recognize today that we didn't recognize as much in the past. Correct. Refraining from cutting down trees, at the same time, the matter of cutting down trees should not be taken lightly. The Gemara notes the case of Rabbi Bar Chanan, who refused to cut down the trees of edge fields in spite of the damage that they caused to his neighbor's vine. Birds used to come down upon the trees and damage the vine. Rabbi claimed that it was forbidden to cut down the trees, and even though the words of Rabbi Chanan who said, my son died only because he cut down a fig tree before its time. Tosfot explained that although it is permitted to cut down a damaging tree, as we saw above, there is room to distinguish between different levels of damage. In the case of Rav, the damage was not severe, and therefore he properly refused to cut down the trees. Based on the ruling of the Rush, the Taz writes that it is permitted to cut down a fruit tree if a person needs the space. For instance, for extending his house or for some other purpose. However, the Netziv writes based on the Rambam that one should be stringent where possible. And the Chatam Sofer writes that where it is possible to relocate the tree of its fruits, one should refrain from cutting it down. In a similar vein, the Chavos Ya'ir writes that one should not cut down fruit trees for reasons of comfort alone, as that wherever possible the branches should be cut and not the entire tree, even if they have to be cut again every few years. Prune rather than cut. Okay, and let's see a little bit more here. Does the prohibition of Baal Tashkit obligate us to actively seek to prevent the waste and destruction? A common related question is whether the connection with catered events in which there is often plenty of food left over. Dealing with the leftovers and ensuring that they are not wasted can involve a considerable expenditure of time and effort, and the question is whether there is an obligation of the Baal Tashkit to make the required arrangements. A number of authorities write that prohibition by Tashkit refers to active waste and destruction, and that there is no formal obligation against passive waste, meaning that the person is not duty-bound to actively prevent destruction and waste. They're saying, I can't take food and just dump it into the garbage. I could make food, then it's left over, it's no longer, edible, okay, and then I get rid of it. You understand? This is, again, a very expansive notion of human rights to sort of use and utilize, our resources. Though there's no full obligation to prevent a caterer from throwing out leftovers, it is certainly virtuous and proper to ensure that leftover food is given to a charity organization or otherwise used and not wasted. The chinuch, we already read that to say for a chinuch. Okay, the chinuch concludes that somebody who is careful of this will be treated by Hashem with the same disposition. Just as he guards the things of the world, so he will forever be forever guarded from all harm. So we see actually quite an expansive notion here of using, you know, resources in the world. It's an interesting question today, now that we know that, you know, trees provide oxygen. By the way, trees also make the certain regions colder. They actually remove heat. They did studies of cities with more trees, and they actually lower the temperature, which is something important in our day and age. So again, we come back to the principle of balance. It's not saying that human beings can't use, you know, you're allowed to cut down a tree. You're allowed to kill an animal. The question is, you know, finding the right balance. How do you do that in a way that has the least negative repercussions? You know what I'm saying? So this is what I think the principle of Baal Tashchit ultimately teaches us. Now, there's a very interesting tshuva here. One second. I want to just get to... Okay, good. We went through those first. Okay, there's a very interesting tshuva. Let's talk for a second about hunting. Hunting.
Hunting permitted according to Judaism.
Did we have any hunters in Tanakh?
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Anybody else?
Was David a hunter? Shepherd.
Right. Although he killed a lion when he was attacked. Say again?
Jonathan, who was accustomed to hunting because he had his arrows, and he took his...
I don't know, did he shoot animals? I don't know if he shot animals, though. I don't know if he shot animals.
What else did he
do? I don't know. No. Okay, hunting for food is... Well, actually, in Judaism, you can't really hunt for food. Okay. You think he was hunting for sport? Okay, so... Okay, for practice, interesting. Say again? Nope, because the animal's going to die because of your bow and arrow or your gun, as opposed to because of shechit. Yeah, you just water. Mm-hmm. Now, the Noda B'Yehuda, Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, okay, lived in the late 19th century. Late 18th century. And he writes, someone writes to him a question and says, listen, I just received this huge piece of land as an inheritance. There are animals on it. Can I go around and hunt? Can I go and hunt? You know, people do these things. I was in Alaska once, and we did a trip over Denali. We flew over Denali. Okay, it happens to be that our plane door opened up and we almost fell out, but that's beside the point. And the plane happened to be from before World War II. Okay, I have to be honest, it wasn't such a pleasant flight, but Alaska's a dangerous place. But the person that we went with on the plane, this is a guy who does these tours out into the wild for 7 days, 10 days, with people who want to go hunt wild animals. You know, he's got all the equipment and he leads, I mean, it was quite you saw in his house, I mean, every wall was filled with trophies of different animals. So the Noda B'Yehuda has asked this question.
They mostly eat it? I don't know.
I'm sure they eat something, but, you know, it's a lot, you kill an animal, it's a lot of meat. V'omnam, me'od ani tama al guf hadavar. Yeah, the Noda B'Yehuda goes through different issues. He's not. This is the end of his tshuva. He's not sure about what to say about this, or he finds it somewhat, you know, problematic. V'lomatinu ish tzayid, rak b'nimrod, v'esav. He doesn't find any hard, you know, very strong prohibition. But he says, wait a second, who are the people who are hunters in Tanakh? Nimrod, Esav. The aims at Darkev b'nei Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. This is not the way of the children of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Ve'ech yamit ish Yisraeli biyadayim ba'alei chayim b'li shum tzarech. How could a Jew kill an animal for no good reason? Rak ligmor chandat Zmano, litasek betida, just for sport, to enjoy, to waste the time. Ve'im yishum shedo dubim uze'ivim u'shar chayot ha'torfim muadim lahazik, if it's because they're coming to destroy, you know, they're dangerous, these animals. There's a Mishnah, and I think it's in Bava Kamma, that says that if a predator is coming to kill you, you can go and kill it first. This is also not true for two reasons. Goes through this. Vamnam gamze eino inyan lenidon didan dehatam kishepo the yishuv mal kombinei adam ehim bal diadam bechol yahagim of shabbat yidusam lefitimo. That's when they come and attack you. But we're not talking about going into nature and just going to find animals to kill them. If an animal comes into the local town and he's going to hurt people, you have to kill it. But that's different. And this is what they say in Masachat Shabbat, Nechashim hargan biyadua shenizdamnu lo lahargan v'chulei, aval lirdof acharein biyarot, makom onatan, kashen regin levod liyishuv, ein kan mitzav, ein kan rak lirdof achar ta'aval libo ve'etzat hanidme ke tavi. He says, it's one thing to save a human being from a dangerous snake. It's another thing to go into the wild and look for dangerous snakes to kill. U'mishu ish ha-tzarich lezeu farnesetom mitzidah kaze, bazeh lo shayach achzariyut. For those who need this for their parnasa, this is not cruel. It's not cruel. V'arei shochtin beimot v'chayot v'ofot. U'mimitim dagin l'tzarech adam. We do kill animals. We eat fish. Okay? However, Zorach Adam, Umali Tehorim Sheochal Mibsarim, Umali Tmeim Sheochal Vifarnes Atzmo Midmei Oroteyen. So there's no difference here between kosher and non-kosher animals. You could eat the kosher animals, you could use the skins of the non-kosher animals. The Chol Balei Chayim Nidnu LaAdam Kol Tzrachav. All animals have been given to human beings to fill their needs. Again, the question is, how do you define needs? How do you define wants? Okay, what's the distinction? Aval Misha Ein Zeh LaTzorach Parnasato. But if it's not for his parnasa, ve'eini kar kavanato klal bishvil parnasato hu achzariyut. If this is not for your parnasa, this is cruelty. Wait a second. What about the situation of the whales in Japan? Right? Why do they kill the whales in Japan? What's the reason? It's what? It's for parnasa. They still do it today. Yeah. It's for whale oil. I don't know, it's possible one can make the guy, I don't know. Hey, this raises an interesting question. You know, killing rhinos for the tusks.
Minks for their coats.
That's, or minks for their coats. That's parnasa, no?
Those are
red. Isn't that parnasa?
But don't they talk something like this is an endangered species, on an endangered species, and you cannot do that.
Okay, so that's according to, okay. Correct. If something is prohibited, one can make the case it isn't prohibited according to American or Israeli or who knows, Filipino law, you know, then there's a principle of dina de malchuta dina. Okay? You can't, you know, you have to follow the law of the land. But is it prohibited to kill an endangered species? If it's for parnasa, like I make money selling tiger skins. That's how I make my money. It's an very interesting question. I mean, I just want to show you, let me show you one piece that's interesting, okay, that connects to this. If you look on page 5, this is from Vogel's article, the second source from the top. It is noteworthy that a significant number of the animals currently protected by either American or international environmental law and whose endangerment has become a focus, second source on page 5.
Oh, yeah,
the middle paragraph. Second paragraph, sorry. It is noteworthy that a significant number of the animals currently protected by either American or international environmental law and whose endangerment has become a focus of considerable public concern are also forbidden to be eaten or sacrificed by Jews. These include lions, tigers, and other animals of the cat family, elephants, bears, rhinoceroses, dolphins, whales, eagles, alligators, and turtles. These are not kosher. The suggestion here is that God permitted animals, that we allowed us to kill animals, which would not become extinct by killing them. Okay, but in terms of endangered species, I mean, there's dina de malchuta dina. there's, I mean, there's Tzar Balei Chaim, but that Tzar Balei Chaim is about the individual animal, you know, causing pain to, but, you know, does it pain a lion that another lion, you know, a lion from Africa that another lion is killed in Asia? I don't know, you know, that's not Tzar Balei Chaim, it's not mistreating this particular animal, you know, and growing them for veal or something. So this is a.
And in certain areas where they put in certain animals, they change the whole environment to the better. Animals.
Okay, so that now it raises a larger question about the ecosystem. You know, if you take certain animals out of the ecosystem, mm-hmm. how does that affect the food chain? How does it affect the environment in general? Is this, you know, creates an imbalance? So in terms of endangered species specifically, it's an interesting question if there's a specific prohibition surrounding it. Raises an interesting question. Okay, besides for the fact that it's illegal according to, you know, the law. Okay, now let's this is in terms of hunting. Okay, let's bring this to a conclusion with the following ideas. First of all, we have Vogel here, who makes a on page 4. You know, he sort of comes to the, again, it's all about balance for him, balance between anthropocentric view and ecocentric view. You know, he says here, as this large body of writing suggests, classical geotics have much to say about the relationship of man to nature. Whatever the merit of White's argument about the environmental implications of the Christian tradition, remember White from the beginning of the Shiur, his criticism is then applied to either the Torah or the teaching of Rabbinic Judaism. Ancient and medieval Jewish texts both express and are consistent with a strong environmental ethic. Okay, etc. But go to the next paragraph. While Judaism may be consistent with many contemporary environmental values and doctrines, its teachings are not identical to them. Specifically, Judaism does not regard the preservation or protection of nature as the most important societal value. It holds that humans are not just a part of nature, but have privileged and distinctive moral claims. It believes that nature can threaten animals as well as the averse. Humans as well as the averse. Meaning, there's an interesting question. Do we see nature as innocent or not? Is nature innocent? Is it just a victim? Or are there things destructive in nature? Is nature a destructive force that sometimes needs to be? So this is a question that comes up. In some of these, you know, radical environmental groups, nature, Mother Earth, is seen as, you know, nothing that it does can you know, there's nothing that needs to be, you know, protected against, or nature should just run totally free. Okay, and this is sort of a response to that. And nature actually is very dangerous sometimes, and nature needs to be controlled. Obviously, it's about a balance. Well, okay, so it believes that nature can threaten humans as well as the adverse. It argues that nature should be used and enjoyed as well as protected. And sure, Judaism contains both green and non-green elements. It is inappropriate to overemphasize either the former as have some Jewish environmentalists, or the latter as have some environmental critics of Western religion. Okay, all about balance. And it's very beautifully summed up by Rabbi Saul Berman here. It is not acceptable, middle of page 5, it is not acceptable in Jewish law to make an assertion of the independent rights of nature. The rights of nature need to be carefully balanced, calibrated against human interests, and that balancing will be the human interests which will have the priority. In short, in Judaism, nature does not have rights, rather humans have responsibilities for the natural world. Okay? A little pushback here from Avraham Lichtenstein against some form of a modern paganism. Secular ecology is generally interested only in nature. It aspires to preserve a particular unit and framework called nature. It emphasizes aesthetics. It seems that it would not be wrong to suggest that what generally hovers over this movement is an idolatrous worship of the land, one of the oldest and the newest forms of idolatry in the world. It is difficult not to hear echoes of the worship of the fertility gods of the ancient world. It is as if at any moment we expect to see those women who would cry over Tammuz in one season and rejoice over his ascendancy at another time. The image of the great mother who hugs all her descendants hovers over everything. The nature of Habalacha is entirely different. The prohibition of one's strength does not come to bestow honor on nature in of itself, rather as a creation and possession of the Holy One, blessed be He. A proof of this point is the very fact that the prohibition does not discriminate between divine and human creation, the one who tears clothing, one who seals a spring. We are not interested in preserving nature, but rather in maintaining reality or maintaining nature. Okay, so We're seeing a variety of different sources here. We certainly, you know, we don't agree with a radical environmental ethic that puts nature above everything else. We certainly don't believe, we don't agree with those who don't care at all about protecting the environment and be dismissive of climate change or destruction, want the destruction of the universe, especially when you have alternative options. there's something realistic about this perspective. I actually took a tour yesterday of Har Gerizim, okay, in the Shomroni village, and we were discussing in the car with a tour guide about, you know, should Jews be, you know, building across the land or up? You know, building up, in some ways it's less aesthetic sometimes, but it's less destructive to the, you know, the surface. It's less destructive to the land itself. And it was the tour guide felt strongly that it's important in Israel, where, you know, it's a little squeezed here sometimes, we should be building up more and not using as much land, you know, horizontally. It's an interesting perspective. But we conclude with Kohelet Rabbah, a very powerful source here. This is from Re'ez Masei Elohim Yuchali Letakein Eit Asher Iveto. Okay, let's look at, God says, look at look at God's creations. Who could fix that which has been made crooked? And there's a beautiful midrash here, perhaps you've heard it before. B'sha'ash barak adash baruch was Adam Rishon, when God created man, natlo v'hechziro kol gan gan Eden. He gave him a Torah, a nature walk of all of the trees in Gan Eden. V'amar lo, and he said, Re'e masai, kama na'im u'meshubachin, and look how beautiful they are. V'chol masha barati b'shvilcha barati, everything I've created for you. Tein da'atcha shelo tekalkel v'tachari v'dolami. Please be careful. Give it thought. Don't destroy my world. She'im kil kalta. If you destroy it, ein mi she'itaken acharecha. No one's gonna save you from yourself. No one's rebuilding this for you. No one's gonna fix up your mess and take out your garbage. Okay. So this is a very powerful and someone's it's terrifying actually reading this. Please, God, we should all recognize our responsibility to protect our planet, to be responsive in a positive way toward, you know, to do something about climate change. But again, we see that Judaism balances different competing interests, and that's the Jewish, this is the encounter between Judaism and environmentalism. Okay, yishar koach, everybody. And let me just,